Welcome back to another episode of This Week in Dystopia. I'm your host, Christopher Robichaud. Today, we are joined by Nicole Hemmer, who is an assistant professor in presidential studies at the Miller Center. After the 2008 election of President Barack Obama, there was an emerging narrative in many circles that this country had made an important turn away from its racist past. And while I don't think anyone could deny that some progress had been made, we had our first black president, Barack Hussein Obama, who enjoyed two full terms in office. What has become more and more clear revelation to at least many people, and not at all a revelation to others, is that this country still has quite a long way to go in wrestling with racism in a wide variety of forms, racism on the streets, and racism in institutions as well. And so as we step back and ask ourselves these questions about the well-functioning of a democracy, what works and what doesn't work, one thing that we have to wrestle with and we will be wrestling with on a regular basis on the show is the role that extreme views and racism and other corrosive ideologies can play in undermining democratic institutions and the pursuit of a better life for everyone. And so it's with that that I am happy to welcome Nicole Hemmer to this program. She is, as I mentioned, an assistant professor at the Miller Center. She's just published an amazing and exciting book, Messengers of the Right, which looks at conservative media activism in the United States. She is a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Reports, and she has her own wonderful and popular podcast, Past Present. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
The alt-right has become the thing that so many people have been talking about, and you yourself have written on this recently because of the events in Charlottesville, which touched you personally. It is your hometown.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like seeing the events of Charlottesville unfold, and in light of that, what reflections we might begin with in terms of understanding the alt-right. What is it? What is the relationship to white supremacy? What have you learned?
So to take a step back, before Charlottesville, I had been writing about the alt-right for a good year. I had written one of the first major looks at the alt-right back in August of 2016, right before Hillary Clinton came out and gave her speech on the alt-right. So it was a world in which I was immersed in a kind of observer way, that I had been studying it, I had been exploring it, but my actual in-person experience with the alt-right was non-existent. Charlottesville changed that. It is my hometown, the place where the so-called rally took place. By the time that I got there, it had dissolved into chaos and violence. Took place just blocks from where I live. And the murder of Heather Heyer took place just blocks from where I live. And I was on scene immediately after the car went through there. I mean, it doesn't tell us anything new about the alt-right. This is who the alt-right has professed to be, and I think we should believe people when they tell us that they are invested in white supremacist ideas. And white supremacy has always relied on violence to hold it up. And what we saw at Charlottesville was a very overt kind of embrace of the violence and hatred that goes into the alt-right, but then also all of the symbols, right? Yeah. Here were people in uniform carrying shields, carrying symbols. I mean, you want to talk about white supremacy and racism and what it looks like. It looks like a lot of different things. But its most overt symbology is when you have a bunch of white guys in uniform standing before a Confederate statue waving Confederate battle flags and Nazi flags. I mean, swastikas did not used to be a part of American politics, and now it is.
I think that's what shocked so many people, and I'm going to include myself amongst them, was the audacity, the brazenness of it. It was so unapologetic and in your face. I want to circle back around on that, but I find it interesting that you were onto the alt-right in some ways before many other people were. What put you onto them? What got you writing about them a year before the events of Charlottesville?
So as someone who studies conservative media, I follow contemporary conservative media. So I spend time on National Review. I spend a lot of time on Breitbart. I have for years. And for me, the big turning point was going into the comments on those websites and seeing those very shocking symbols, seeing the memes, seeing swastikas, seeing anti-Semitic slurs and symbols and all these different things. And this was actually part of the media strategy of the alt-right. I mean, this is what's so fascinating. They got my attention because they wanted outside attention. If we think back to the summer of 2016, journalists were being inundated with swastikas, images from Nazi death camps, images of lynchings. That was a strategy to get members of the mainstream media to notice that something was happening with the alt-right. It called attention to them. That's when I started studying them and writing about them, because I probably was onto it a little earlier and saw the way that it was penetrating conservative media sites in a really disruptive way. But pretty shortly after, I mean, once Donald Trump hired Steve Bannon, that brought Breitbart into the campaign, and then Hillary Clinton gave her alt-right speech, suddenly everyone was able to start talking about the alt-right.
I'm curious on what you think emboldened them. In other words, my thought would be, here's an extremely fringe group that knows that it has extraordinarily distasteful and overwhelmingly unwelcome ideas across wide swaths of the American public. Stick to the far corners of the internet, stick to the chat rooms, don't show yourself in the light of day. Wear hoods, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're suggesting that they wanted to be discovered. They wanted to be heard. What in the world emboldened them to take that step, do you think?
I think part of it was the embrace by certain parts of conservative media. One of the things that Steve Bannon wanted to do with Breitbart, starting in 2013, 2014, around the time of something called Gamergate, was to harness that rage that was coming from these white men online and to turn it away from video games, which was at the heart of Gamergate. Well, anti-woman politics is at the heart of it, but video games, and bring it into voting, bring it into politics. And so taking a site that had lots of visitors and legitimizing the alt-right. I mean, he gave them a media home that connected them into mainstream politics. And I think that emboldened them quite a lot. And then, of course, the candidacy of Donald Trump. I mean, when you have a presidential candidate who's saying all of these offensive things in the same way that you've been online for years saying all of these offensive things, and yet he's about to become the nominee of the Republican Party, that's going to give you a bit of hope as to the mainstreaming of your ideas. So yes, they absolutely started out as a fringe group. You could argue that in some ways some of them are. I mean, I don't think that swastikas are broadly embraced by Americans as a positive political symbol. But a lot of those ideas in different forms are now at the heart of our politics.
So we have a conscious effort to mobilize, organize, and empower this group. Finding them in the Gamergate community, I was quite aware of that as well, mm-hmm. as a lifetime gamer, and it was quite appalling what emerged from there. All right, so fast forwarding then back to Charlottesville, here we have a group. They've been empowered. They've been emboldened. They feel they have more legitimacy than they've ever had before. Now President Trump is in office. Now Steve Bannon is at his side. And now there's a decision to remove the Confederate statues mm-hmm. in Charlottesville, and we have all the events that unfolded. For a lot of the country, it was a wake-up call. But as I mentioned earlier, for a lot of the country, it wasn't a wake-up call. It was business as usual. And I remember reading a lot of commentary that said, who is really surprised by this? Did you really think we had turned the corner that we did? From a historical perspective, what are some of your thoughts about this? There seems to be something new going on, but there also seems to be something quite old.
Right. So it's interesting in your introduction when you were talking about, you know, people who saw Barack Obama's election as a moment of racial healing or putting racism behind us. I would imagine 99.99% of those people were white. I don't think that a lot of non-white people saw Obama's election as the end of racism, so to speak. When it comes to historical perspectives on the alt-right, on the one hand, there is something quite old about them. I mean, white nationalism is as old as the nation here in the United States. I mean, probably the newest thing in the United States is the idea that white nationalism would be sidelined, which doesn't really start to happen until the 1960s. And so that in and of itself is kind of new. White nationalism is an old idea. There's a big strain of anti-feminist, anti-woman politics that often gets ignored when we talk about the alt-right. That, too, quite old in the United States.
Yes.
What is new is how the alt-right presents itself and the tactics that it uses. For instance, and I think this is perhaps the most important innovation of the alt-right, is that they've framed their politics and their activism in terms of free speech. That actually, that people who are talking about racism and misogyny and all of these things, those people are distracting you from the real issue, which is that in America, we should be able to say whatever we want. And this PC culture that has emerged since the 1990s has been responsible for destroying the freedom of people to say what they want. It has taken issues off the table and made us a worse country for that. And when you move the argument onto the grounds of free speech, A, you find a lot of allies.
Yes.
It's something especially among conservatives that they have latched on to that free speech anti-PC argument, but among some liberals as well. So you do that. And you also turn attention away from the ideas that you're arguing for free speech in defense of.
Right.
White nationalism, right. Anti-woman politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Islamist politics, pro-white politics. And so it's a really effective sleight of hand. I mean, there are other novel things as well, the use of social media, the use of memes, new language like red pill and cuck and all of these things that make the alt-right a distinct historical phenomenon. I would say, though, that even that isn't too new. One of the things that I think most journalists miss or misunderstand when it comes to racism in the United States is they think that racism looks like the Klan. They think that it looks like a sepia-toned photo. Racism in the United States has always refashioned itself in the most modern garb. And so journalists are getting obsessed with the fact that Richard Spencer wears a nice suit,
yeah.
Kind of nice suit, or look at his hairstyle or the yeah. fancy food that he eats. And they completely miss that this is how racism works. It's eugenics using cutting-edge science in the 1920s. It's the Klan using the fraternal orders that are so popular in its time. And then it's the alt-right using online venues and social media. That process isn't new. What it looks like is.
So one of the things that really interested me in what you've mentioned is this use of the freedom of speech as a mechanism to get more people on board with the white nationalist agenda. As someone who takes free speech very, very mm-hmm. seriously, I've noticed this. I've noticed this attempt to co-opt it for corrupt ends. And I'm just worried that it is an effective strategy. Not insofar as it's going to turn, 50%+ of the country in favor of white nationalists. I think we've seen in the polls that people are largely still intolerant of this group. But just the idea of turning a principle that's quite sacred on its end in order to advance this kind of cause. I just find that fascinating and worth dwelling on for a minute. Do you see the ongoing battle over free speech in the public, on campuses, and so forth, as one that conservatives in general and the alt-right as a branch of that, is this a winning strategy in the long term?
So far, it has been. Okay. I mean, so far they have won a number of allies, including at universities, among journalists. I mean, they've won friends by making these free speech arguments. Oh, I'm going to take the Voltaire line that I may disagree with you, but I will defend to the death your right to say these odious things. And so people latch on to that. And that's all well and good. I mean, I consider myself often, I used to consider myself at least a free speech absolutist. And certainly certainly in terms of the formal definition of free speech, the alt-right has that.
Yes.
They can say whatever they want and the government isn't going to interfere with what they say. The thornier question is, A, should universities invite people onto campus who disagree, who want to have an open debate about the fundamental humanity of other people based on their race or their religion or their sex? There was a time you could have that debate in American universities. There was a time until the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s that wasn't even an open debate. That was an assumption that some people had more rights to the gifts of the nation than others because they were male or because they were white or because they were Christian. We don't live in that polity anymore. And that's why we're grappling with these kinds of questions right now, because now there is a fundamental disagreement. And for universities that claim to be committed to this broader liberal, not politically liberal, but kind of humanities liberal process, I mean, do you have a debate on your campus like they had on CNN about whether Jews are people?
So speaking of free speech, right, free speech is protected by the First Amendment, but the First Amendment is not just about free speech per se. It's also about freedom of the press, related, obviously, but distinct. And you've done a lot of interesting work on the emergence of activist conservative media and its role in attacking sort of mainstream journalistic institutions, or at least its effect on mainstream journalistic institutions. I think we all agree that at this point there's been profound erosion of trust in the media. This is something that our president certainly facilitates on a very regular basis. But even without President Trump attacking the media, most polls show widespread distrust and disdain almost in mainstream journalism. This didn't happen by accident, and it seems to me that you think that in part of the story, at least, is comes out of conservative activist media. Share with us some of your research and where it led you.
Absolutely. So I started back in 2005, 2006, looking into the history of conservative media, which I actually traced back into the 1940s and the 1950s, which is a really interesting time to have this partisan ideological media emerging, because it's emerging at a time when, A, conservatives didn't have a ton of power. They were kind of shut out of both major parties. The Republican Party wasn't really the conservative party. It was on board with a lot of the New Deal. It was on board with an interventionist foreign policy. There were a lot of things conservatives disagreed with that both parties agreed on. And it's also a time in which the exact opposite of what you're describing was happening. Americans trusted the media, the media, such as it was, which was actually a fairly small media, right? We're talking about, by the 1950s, three television networks that everyone who had a television watched the nightly news. We're talking about a few papers of record, plus local papers and local radio shows and things like that. But it was a fairly consensus period for both political parties and for media. And these conservatives operated outside of that. They were seen as fringe. And they were seen as too outside the norm.
Did they publish newspapers? Was that it? I mean, was it?
Well, so what ended up happening was, because they didn't feel like their voices were being heard in the mainstream media, they founded their own media outlets. And that included things like Human Events, which was kind of a news weekly, National Review, which was a magazine, the Mannion Forum and the Smoot Report, which were radio and then television shows, things like Regnery Publishing, which was a book publishing house. So really, they expand out very quickly into all different media forms.
Okay.
And they use those media, they go into those media because they believe that if they can control the message, they can change politics. They believed that media was the starting point for political change. And one of the big things that they did was they frontally attacked that idea that Americans should trust existing mainstream normal media. They, in fact, suggested that you couldn't, that you weren't actually getting the truth.
Because their perspective wasn't represented there? Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. So their perspective wasn't represented. That they were giving you a different kind of rubric for who to trust.
Okay.
Trust us because our ideas are right. Sometimes we might not always get the facts right, but we will get the truth right. And that's really important, because if you're saying trust me because of my ideology, as opposed to trust me for my professionalism, or trust me because I've been hired to be the anchor of this nightly news show, you know, trust me because you agree with me politically.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of claim for who you should trust.
Yeah, that's I never thought about it like that, but that's a really interesting way of going in. The trust is based on the ideological commitments, and everything else flows from that.
Right. But what they were doing was they were saying, and also the reason you should trust us based on our ideological commitments is because Walter Cronkite is telling you he's objective. He's not. He's a liberal. He's feeding you an ideological line, too. Your choice is between competing ideologies. Objectivity is a mask meant to disguise that they're doing the same thing that we are setting out to do. And that was the big missing piece, right? That they wanted to dismantle objectivity by arguing that actually no one is objective, right? That we're all making ideological claims. The difference is our ideological claims are right.
So take us from the emergence of that in the 40s and 50s to where we are today. And hopefully by way of Rush Limbaugh, who I think has to be part of that conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think before we can stop in the 1980s and 1990s, we have to make a quick detour into the late 1960s and 70s, because you mentioned that conservative media were part of the equation. And I do think one of the things that had to happen was Americans needed to lose faith in media more broadly. Hmm. And they didn't lose faith in media more broadly because of National Review.
Okay.
They lost faith in media more broadly because it turned out that they weren't getting the truth, that actually the government had lied about things like Vietnam. The government was pretty untrustworthy, and the media hadn't told them either.
They viewed the media as complicit in that?
They did view the media as complicit in that. They saw a media that had sort of passed along what the government said as though it were true instead of questioning it. And over the course of the late 1960s and 1970s, Americans were losing faith in all institutions, and the media were among them. And I think it's important to understand that as that sort of faith in media is beginning to fracture, you have in office politicians in the White House, Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew,
yes,
who frontally attack the media. Who say, actually, you know, the reason we're losing in Vietnam is not because of what's happening in the administration. It's because these media keep telling you that we're losing. If journalists would stop saying that we're losing, we wouldn't be losing, right?
I'm getting worried because of the parallels that you're drawing between.
You should be a little worried.
Yeah.
And so that loss of faith in media was really pivotal for creating a space where conservatives could take that claim that they'd been working on since the 1940s and actually use it to change American journalism. And in fact, they do. I mean, the model really shifts from objectivity as objective to objectivity as balance. You know, we're not going to be able to present the one view. What we can do is we can give you a person from the left and a person from the right, and that's how we're going to be objective. And that's the environment in which you get Rush Limbaugh, who goes national in 1988, Fox News, which goes live in 1996. And by the time they emerge, the arguments necessary for them to emerge had already been won.
Hmm.
The idea of fair and balanced had become an operating principle for mainstream journalism for well over a decade by that point. It's just that Fox took it and ran with it.
I feel that at this stage, mainstream media is wholly on the defensive. Is there a way forward? Is there a healing? Is there a way to rebuild trust? Or is the game lost?
I don't know if the game is lost. I mean, this is the most pressing question in American politics and American life right now, is can faith in institutions be rebuilt? If it can't, game over.
Yeah.
If it can, and I'm enough of an optimist to say that I hope that it can, I think that there is one model that we can look to if we go back to the 60s and 70s. There is a moment, as Americans are losing faith in media, that they get it back. And that's when journalists expose the wrongdoings that are happening in the White House and the critical investigative journalism that was happening in the early 1970s. That was really important for exposing, actually, and then diminishing Americans' trust in government, because journalists were able to reveal so much of this wrongdoing. But that kind of sharp, critical, difficult investigative journalism didn't become the model for what journalists as a whole did going forward, right? That this balance model became much more prominent, perhaps because of the rise of non-print media. As television news becomes more and more prominent, there's not as much space for that, I think. And so we have a media environment today, I think, working against us on this. But one of the things that has to happen, one of the things we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years is how consequential the new media model of false,
yes,
balance and false equivalency is. So we don't want any more of that.
Right.
But the question,
right,
is what replaces it? Because if what replaces it is more of the same or something just as impoverished, why would anyone trust a media that's not serving anyone. And I think that's the kind of soul searching that journalists have to do going forward, is what do you owe the public and how are you going to get there? And that public interest is difficult to pursue when there are so many other pressing, particularly economic issues facing journalists. So it's a tough road ahead.
I guess I'll share your optimism if only because recently it seems we have some evidence that this investigative model is alive and well because of its consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Good old-fashioned journalism was able to cause one cabinet member to resign. So Tom Price was good old-fashioned journalism that got Tom Price to face the music and eventually have to resign. Good old-fashioned journalism has given us Harvey Weinstein, finally, after so many years. In other words, it still has some bite, despite being delegitimized so much from the powers that be. Is that overly optimistic to point to these things and say, well, it hasn't been wholly defanged, it can still attack power in government, power in Hollywood, and produce results? Should we? I don't want to, run away with my hands up in the air saying we're all good, but there's some hope in that, isn't there?
Yes, there's some space between we're all good and we're all doomed, and I think we are in that space. I would say that at the same time, good investigative journalism isn't enough, because what did we see in the election? We saw investigative journalism that brought forward women who had accused Donald Trump of sexual assault, that brought forward the Access Hollywood tape, that brought forward all sorts of corrupt and questionable and really terrible things from Trump's past. And it didn't change the outcome of the election.
If you don't mind me jumping in on that, and this is something I keep going back and forth about, like, is that a problem with journalism or is that a problem with our culture? I mean, it seems like here's a bunch of evidence. And horrifyingly, no one cared.
Right. And that I guess, is my point about I don't know which side of we're all good and we're all doomed we're actually in. If journalism reaches some perfect ideal that somebody has of what journalism should best do in a well-functioning democracy, well, what happens when it's not a well-functioning democracy?
Right, right.
Maybe journalism doesn't have the same kind of political and cultural power if its main weapon is facts, and you have a population that doesn't care about facts, then they're defanged by that. Not by their practices, but by the lack of receptivity to their ideas. Now, I don't think we're in that stark of a situation, but I do think that the thorniest part of all of this is that our problems right now aren't a lack of good information. They're a lack of caring about good information. And that's a civic problem that maybe you can fix generationally through education, in my most optimistic imaginings. But people use different sets of truth claims because it benefits them. And how you dissuade someone from doing something that benefits them, that's tough.
A lot to think about, a lot of heavy stuff. Nicole Hemmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We will return next week for another week in dystopia. Thank you very much, everyone.